नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरयत्। Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the very means of conquest, we should offer our respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Lord Narayan, unto Nara Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author. This morning we're continuing in Srimad Bhagavatam in Canto 1, Chapter 9, the passing away of Bhishma Dev. Today's verse is text 37, which is not on the board. Isi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Fulfilling my desire and sacrificing his own promise, he got down from the chariot, took up its wheel, and ran towards me hurriedly, just like a lion goes to kill an elephant. He even dropped his outer garment on the way. Purport. The battle of Kurukshetra was fought on military principles, but at the same time in a sporting spirit, like a friend's fight with another friend. Duryodhana criticized Bhishma Dev, alleging that he was reluctant to kill Arjuna because of paternal affection. A Kshatriya cannot tolerate insults on the principle of fighting. Bhishma Dev therefore promised that the next day he would kill all five Pandavas with special weapons made for the purpose. Duryodhana was satisfied, and he kept the arrows with him to be delivered the next day during the fight. By tricks, Arjuna took the arrows from Duryodhana, and Bhishma Dev could understand that this was the trick of Lord Krishna. So he took a vow that the next day Krishna would have to take up weapons himself. Otherwise, his friend Arjuna would die. In the next day's fighting, Bhishma Dev fought so violently that both Arjuna and Krishna were in trouble. Arjuna was almost defeated. The situation was so tense that he was about to be killed by Bhishma Dev the very next moment. At that time, Lord Krishna wanted to please his devotee, Bhishma, by keeping Bhishma's promise, which was more important than his own. Seemingly, he broke his own promise. He promised before the beginning of the battle of Kurukshetra that he would remain without weapons and would not use his strength for either of the parties. But to protect Arjuna, he got down from the chariot, took up the wheel of the chariot, and hurriedly rushed at Bhishma Dev in an angry mood, as a lion goes to kill an elephant. He dropped his covering cloth on the way, and out of great anger he did not know that he had dropped it. Bhishma Dev at once gave up his weapons and stood to be killed by Krishna, his beloved Lord. The fighting of the day was thus ended at that very moment, and Arjuna was saved. Of course, there was no possibility of Arjuna's death because the Lord himself was on the chariot, but because Bhishma Dev wanted to see Lord Krishna take up some weapon to save his friend, the Lord created this situation, making Arjuna's death imminent. He stood before Bhishma Dev to show him that his promise was fulfilled and that he had taken up the wheel. Svanigamam apahaya mat pratigyam ritam adikartum avapluto ratastaha dritta ratta charano vyayach chalad gur harir ivahantum ibham gototariya. Fulfilling my desire and sacrificing his own promise, he got down from the chariot, took up its wheel, and ran towards me hurriedly, just as a lion goes to kill an elephant. He even dropped his outer garment on the way. Mukham karoti vachalam magam mangayate garim yat kripataram bande shri gurundina taranam. So this is a description of the ghastly rasa. The ghastly rasa is a transcendental rasa, a transcendental loving relationship with Krishna. But it seems to take awful forms. So Bhishma Dev is Lord Krishna's pure devotee. And yet we see that in the battle of Kurukshetra, the relationship with Krishna was one of antagonism, actually fighting. Krishna, as explained here, Srila Prabhupada has explained in detail how, first of all, Duryodhana taunted Bhishma Dev, that Arjuna is your favorite and therefore you're sparing him. So because Bhishma, this is the dealings between Kshatriyas, Kshatriya cannot tolerate such kind of taunting. So then Bhishma Dev vowed, all right, tomorrow Arjuna will be finished. Actually, he vowed to kill all 5 Pandavas the next day. And he had special weapons, 5 special arrows for this purpose. And Duryodhana, he was keeping those arrows. He wanted to keep them very securely. But that night, because when the battle ended each day, then in the evening the two camps would become friends. They were so closely related. So they would cross the enemy lines and meet with one another and speak freely. So Arjuna came, and he came into the camp of the Kauravas. And Duryodhana, on greeting Arjuna, said, "So whatever you want, Arjuna, I'm prepared to give you." So then Arjuna asked, "Give me those 5 arrows." So Duryodhana had to do it, because this is the Kshatriya's word. If he promises something, then his whole honor is at stake. So he had to give those 5 arrows. So anyway, the next day, Bhishma Dev, even without those arrows, he vowed to fulfill his promise, at least of killing Arjuna. So he attacked Arjuna very, very vigorously. And so strong was his attack that Arjuna's chariot was broken, and as Srila Prabhupada explains here, in the very next moment Arjuna was to be killed. But then Lord Krishna, he picked up one of the broken wheels of the chariot and he ran towards Bhishma Dev. Now, this is interesting. Krishna could have called for his chakra, but he took up the chariot wheel, because a chariot wheel is not, it's not exactly a weapon. Krishna had vowed, "I won't take up weapons." So, chariot wheel is not exactly a weapon. Of course, Lord Krishna came with the wheel with the intention of using it as a weapon. And as he was running towards Bhishma Dev, Bhishma Dev was firing arrows into Lord Krishna's body. And Lord Krishna was exhibiting blood. And then Krishna came before Bhishma Dev and said, "All right. So you forced me. I know your real desire in all of this was not actually to kill Arjuna, but actually was to force me to take up a weapon and defend Arjuna. So I've done this. So now you stop." So Bhishma Dev, he put down his weapons and he stood very humbly before the Lord. And the fight for that day came to an end. So this is ghastly rasa. Just see this exchange between Bhishma and Krishna. Bhishma is firing arrows into Krishna's body, making Krishna bleed. Krishna is running towards Bhishma with a chariot wheel in his hand, threatening to kill Bhishma Dev. So someone may say, "And what is the difference between this relationship between Grandfather Bhishma and Krishna and, say, Krishna's relationship with Kamsa or Shishupal or other demons that also came before Krishna with raised weapons and were attacking him? How is this ghastly rasa any different? Or is it the same?" So Gauranga Premananda, this is the question that you have to answer today. Doesn't matter. Brahman is always prepared to give knowledge. So is Bhishma on the same level as the demons, or are the demons on the same level as him, or what's going on?
Between Krishna and Bhishma, it was a play. But Kamsa, he was really deep. Really aggressive and hateful.
Okay, actually that's the answer. That is the answer. The devotees of the Lord, their relationship with Krishna, as described by Rupa Goswami, is anukulyena. It is favorable. Anukulyena anushilanam. Anushilanam means it's referring to the service that they render, the love and devotion that they offer to the Lord in their service. And anukulyena refers to the mood. that the mood of a devotee is always favorable. His intention is always to give delight, to give pleasure to Krishna. And so there are these five main rasas and seven sub-rasas, one of which is ghastly. So the Lord even takes pleasure in that way, which is very remarkable. But even let's take a more obviously pleasing rasa. We may find the ghastly rasa a little difficult to understand. So let's take the relationship between Mother Yashoda and Lord Krishna. So there is the instance in the pastime of the binding of Lord Krishna. So just a little before that, the scene opened with Mother Yashoda breastfeeding child Krishna. And then a pot which was on the stove boiled over. So what did Yashoda do? Who remembers? Just at that moment. Yes? Yeah, she put Krishna down and went to attend to the pot. And what was Krishna's reaction? Yeah, he was very unhappy. So if a devotee is supposed to please Krishna, then what kind of devotee is Mother Yashoda? Gauranga, what's your answer? Krishna was crying, he was displeased.
Yeah, Krishna sometimes likes to display this kind of emotions.
Yes, this is all part and parcel of the Vatsalya Rasa, of the relationship of parent to child, which Krishna enjoys with Yashoda. So in that relationship, sometimes Mother Yashoda has to attend to her household duties. And then as we see, as this pastime progressed, she even had to correct the Lord for his misbehavior. This is what a mother must do. And you know, sometimes a child seems to be not very happy with mother's activities. Lord Krishna was crying. But this is all part and parcel of the blissful loving exchange between mother, divine mother, and divine son. So it is all perfect. It is all anukulyena. It is favorable. It is all for giving pleasure to Krishna. So now the demons, like Kamsa and so on, their intention was not to give pleasure to Krishna. Their intention is, of course, antagonistic. They're full of malice. They actually want to kill Krishna. They actually do not understand who Lord Krishna is. Grandfather Bhishma, he knew full well who Lord Krishna was. That's why here, in his passing away, he's offering these wonderful prayers to Lord Krishna. He's considering it his greatest fortune to be able to leave his body while seeing Lord Krishna. So, of course, Krishna, he's all blissful in all circumstances. So even when the demons attack, he's enjoying that. From his side, he's enjoying. It's also for Krishna sporting when some demon comes and curses Krishna and threatens, "I will now cut off your head." Like Hiranyakashipu said, "I will cut off Vishnu's head and offer his blood to my departed brother who is so fond of sucking blood." So Krishna enjoys this. But of course the demon, he's not intending to share any favorable rasa with the Lord. So the demon is counted out by his malicious, antagonistic behavior. So this is a wonderful instance described in this verse and purport of love between the Lord and his devotee being exchanged through the ghastly rasa. So I'm going to go on to read another, a bit more from Ramayana. But are there any questions on this so far? Bhagavatam, verse and purport. No? All right, so then we will continue with the Ramayana reading, which we started last night. Now, this section we're going to read is background information. This is a collection of from different scriptures, insights into the history of Lanka and the history of Ravana and a few other things, which helps us. Hearing these will help us to understand the background of Ramayana more. So now we will hear about Sri Lanka, first of all. Sri Lanka is, of course, a city, but it's also the name of the island on which the city of Lanka was built. Now, this island is actually originally a mountain. Of course, one can say, well, all islands in the ocean are mountains. But this was actually part of Mount Meru. It was called Trikutagiri. Trikutagiri means a peak with three points on top. And this was a huge piece of rock, which broke a long, long, long time before. Of course, Ramayana is already a long, long time ago. Pastimes of Lord Ram occurred 2 million years ago. And a long, 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 long time before that, a piece of the Meru mountain broke off and came to be known as Trikutagiri, or Lanka. So this started when there was a discussion between two Gandharvas. And they were arguing. Each one was taking the side of Vasuki, the great snake, as being the strongest. And the other was taking the side of Vayu, the wind god. So one Gandharva said, you know, I saw myself. I was present at the time Vasuki was, he was tied from the horn of Matsya Avatar to the ship on which Satyavrata and the seven sages were staying with the Vedas at the time of dissolution. And Matsya Avatar was swimming along and pulling the boat behind him, and Vasuki was acting as the rope. So I know from seeing this that Vasuki is the strongest. Who could have done this? Actually, the Lord himself, Lord Matsya, selected Vasuki for this service. So the Lord knows that he's the strongest. And then the other Gandharva was arguing that Vayu is so powerful. So as they were talking like this, Vayu, who is of course air, he's all-pervading. So he heard this conversation. Vayu can hear everything that is spoken. So he appeared on the scene. And he said, what kind of discussion are you having? And they asked, who are you? And he said, I am Vayu, the god of wind. Why do you even bother to discuss that someone can be stronger than me? Don't you know I am all-pervading, therefore I'm here because I hear you? So then the one Gandharva, he was still insisting that Vasuki is very strong. So then Vayu said, all right, then we can have a test. So Vasuki and Vayu, they discussed how they would compete with one another. And it was decided that Vasuki would coil three times around Mount Meru. And he would grip Mount Meru with his coils very tightly. And Vayu would try to blow him off the mountain. Now, they didn't ask Meru if they could do this. Now, Meru didn't mind when he saw Vasuki coming. He even didn't mind when Vasuki wrapped his coils around him three times. Meru was thinking, anyway, there's so many snakes, because Meru is a huge mountain, a cosmic mountain. And there's so many snakes living on my body, so it's all right. But then Vasuki started to squeeze. He was constricting the mountain. And at the same time, Vayu, the wind god, began to beat against Mount Meru like a with full hurricane force. So this was actually creating such a disturbance for Meru. Actually, Vasuki, he was hanging on, and Vayu was blowing, so they were having no problem. They were just having fun. But Meru, he became so distressed that he screamed, "If you don't stop this, I'm going to just turn upside down." Now, because all the planets in the universe are connected with Meru. Meru is the central axis around which all the heavenly bodies revolve. So if Meru were to become overturned, then that would mean more or less the end of the whole universe. All the planets would be devastated. So when the demigods came to know this, they prayed to Lord Brahma, "Please save this situation, because the universe is about ready to go topsy-turvy." So then Brahma, he came and he stopped Meru, he stopped Vasuki and he stopped Vayu from bothering Meru like this. And he told them that why you compete, because each of you are very powerful, but you have a different kind of strength. Vayu, you can't exhibit the kind of strength that Vasuki exhibits. Because Vasuki is very powerful and constricting. And Vasuki, you can't send wind with hurricane force. That's a different kind of strength. So just be satisfied in your own qualities and don't compete. So then when Vasuki let go of Meru, then a piece of Meru broke off. And this was this Trikutagiri. So Trikutagiri fell into the ocean, and its three peaks were left protruding above the ocean like an island. So Vishvakarma, he built a very nice palace, or not just one palace, but a whole city of palaces on this Trikutagiri. And this city, very palatial city, which he built for the demigods, this was a kind of like pleasure vacation spot for the demigods. So this became known as Sri Lanka. So later, Kuvera, who from the family of the Yakshas and Rakshasas, but by austerity, by his great austerity and by his saintly qualities, he was accepted by the demigods as their treasurer. So they gave him Lanka City. They said, "You can stay there." So in great jubilation, he took over Lanka. Now Ravana is a cousin brother of Kuvera. Ravana's mother is sister of Kuvera's mother. So there was a great rivalry between these two women. So when Ravana was born, and then after Ravana was born, Kumbhakarna, and then Bibhishana and Supurnaka. So Ravana's mother, she encouraged Ravana that you should do like Kuvera did, perform austerities, but you become so powerful that you take away Lanka from him. So she was inducing her son like this to defeat the son of her sister. So they performed great austerities in the Himalayas, and Brahma appeared. So when Brahma came before Ravana, then Ravana asked for all sorts of greedy benedictions. He was asking that he may not be killed by demigods, by demons, by beasts, by all sorts of living entities. Only one class of living entity he left out, that was human beings. The reason he left out is because he's Rakshasa, and the human beings are the food of the Rakshasas. So he thought, "I won't have any trouble from them, so I don't have to ask for that benediction." But of course, he was not considering that the Supreme Lord would appear in the human society as Ramchandra and be the cause of his death. And he received all other sorts of benedictions from Brahma. Then Brahma came before Kumbhakarna. Now Kumbhakarna intended to ask for Nityatvam, which meant, let me be eternal. Nityatvam. But Brahma's consort, Saraswati Devi, who gives power of speech, she interfered with Kumbhakarna's tongue. So, although he intended to say Nityatvam, it came out Nidratvam. Nidra means sleep. So, instead of asking, may I live forever, he asked, may I sleep forever. So Brahma said, yes, so be it. Tatastu, you have your wish. And Kumbhakarna said, wait a minute, that's not fair. That was a mistake. What's the use of having my having to perform all these austerities for a boon, and then the boon will be that I just sleep? So then Brahma, he adjusted his benediction. He said, all right, you'll sleep for 6 months at a time. And then when you wake up for 6 months, you'll eat. And then go back to sleep for another 6 months. This is a good life for a demon. So Kumbhakarna, he would sleep like that, a very sound, intense, deep sleep. And when it was time to wake him up, it took a whole army. A whole army would come and walk across his chest with elephants, and they would beat on drums, and they would blow horns. And still he wouldn't wake up, so then they would start to fire arrows into his body and set a fire on his chest. And then gradually, in his ignorant state, he would feel something. So then he would rear up out of his sleep. And just by moving his limbs like this, so many soldiers and elephants would be killed because he was such a huge demon. And then they would bring all kinds of horrible foodstuffs. And he would eat this for 6 months straight. He would be eating tons and tons of fish and flesh and other abominable things. And the first time he woke up after his first 6 months of sleep, then there were many brahmanas there who were reciting Vedic hymns. This was his Gurukul instruction while he was eating. He was eating the whole time. Nom, 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 nom. But he was so intelligent at the same time that by hearing these Brahmins reciting the Vedas for 6 months, he learned all the Vedas. Now, when he would sleep, he would leave his body, in his astral body, and he would tour the universe. He went to Kailash and he performed mystic yoga in his subtle body and pleased Lord Shiva, and in this way he got so many benedictions from Lord Shiva. Let's see if they're mentioned here. Yes, he got astras, weapons from Lord Shiva. So in this way Kumbhakarna became very powerful by receiving benedictions and doing so many things in his subtle body. Then it was the Bibhishana's turn. Brahma came before Bibhishana. And when Brahma asked him, what do you want? Bibhishana said, please give me pure devotion to the Supreme Lord. And let me always be unwavering in this devotion, even in bad association. Of course, by that he meant in the association of demons like Ravana and Kumbhakarna. So when Ravana heard this, he said, oh no, here's another one. He said, there was already Prahlad in our family, and now we have another one. What is this? And then he was rebuking his brother. Look, Brahma is here. Why don't you ask for something useful? Brahma can give you anything within this universe. That's what we want. We want to enjoy life. And you're asking for devotion to the Supreme Lord. Then Shupurnaka, who is the Lady Rakshasa, she asked for the benediction to change her form, any form she liked. That's how, although she's a demoness in the forest, much later on, when she saw Ram and Lakshman, she fell in love with them. And so she assumed the form of a most beautiful young girl to try to attract them. And you know the story. Then back and forth, Ram and Lakshman were joking. Ram was saying, I already have a wife. But my brother, Lakshman, he's here alone. He's left his wife back in Ayodhya. So he needs female companionship. So go to him. And then Lakshman would say, no, I'm just serving my brother. I'm just a servant. I can't take care of a woman. You see, I'm carrying all these things for my brother. So he can accept you. He's the king of Ayodhya. He can have many wives. Go back. So in this way, she was going back and forth. And as she was being sent back and forth, she was always hearing the name Sita. Because they were telling how Sita Devi is the wife of... Because Ram would say, Sita is my wife, so I can't accept you. And Lakshman would say, he's only got one wife. Sita is his only wife, so he can certainly accept you. So she was gradually starting to understand that it's because of the Sita that they're not accepting me. And Sita had just been a little distance away in the forest. So she happened to appear. She came back at this time. And so Supurnaka, when she saw Sita Devi, she said, you're the reason why these fine young men are rejecting me. So I will gobble you up. And then they will have to accept me. So when she said this, then Lakshman cut off her nose and ears and sent her on her way. And she went back to Ravana, and that's... Anyway, the Ramayana continues, but we're not going that far. We're looking at background information. So... Yes, here it is mentioned that a region on the southern point of India, Janastan, was protected by Ravana's two other brothers. Their names were Kara and Dushana. They were also there receiving benedictions from Brahma. They became very powerful soldiers, and they became the guards of Janastan with 14,000 Rakshasas. So what happened was is that after Shupurnaka was mutilated by Lanka, by Lakshman, and she went back to Lanka and complained, then message was sent to Kara and Dushana and these 14,000 Rakshasa soldiers that you should take action against Ram and Lakshman. So they attacked and they were destroyed. Actually, they were so easily destroyed. And the news came back. They were all destroyed, I think it says here, let's see, with one arrow. Something like that. Anyway, with very minimum display of force, Ram and Lakshman destroyed Kara, Dushana and 14,000 demons. So, that's why Ravana sent Maricha to take the form of a deer, a spotted deer, very beautiful deer, to attract Ram and Lakshman away from Sita Devi so that he could kidnap her. So now there's a little bit of background about Ravana, a little more about him. Ravana was known as Shastragya. He knew all the Shastras because he's the son of a Brahmana. And he was so expert in chanting Sanskrit verses that the demigods would invite Ravana to come and sit in their yagyas just to chant mantras. But there was always a problem with this, because at the same time Ravana was so lusty. So once when Ravana was chanting mantras at a yajna, Agni, hearing these mantras, he thought, I have to personally appear there with my wife. His wife's name is Svaha. Agni is the fire, and Svaha Devi is the flame of the fire. So she's very, very beautiful. So Agni thought, listen, just listen to how Ravana is chanting those mantras. They're so expert. It is so beautiful. So I must appear there and personally bless him along with my wife. And Brahma said, don't take your wife. And Agni said, no, he's chanting so nicely. Svaha Devi should also come. And Brahma said, all right, you can see what happens. This may be a lesson for you. So then Agni and Svaha, they appeared out of the flame of the yajna. And Agni was just raising his hand to give the blessing. And suddenly, Ravana, he just dropped everything and leaped on Svaha and took her away. He was suddenly flying off in space. And Agni was there. I wanted to give you a blessing. What? And now you took my wife. And he was really lamenting. The Brahmins who were performing the sacrifice, when they saw Ravan, he dropping everything and approaching Svaha, they said, Ravan, it's now time for Purnahuti. That's the most important part, the end of the sacrifice. It's now time for Purnahuti. What are you doing? He said, oh, who cares about Purnahuti? Woman is more important. So this was the problem with Ravana. He was so expert in chanting and so full of Vedic knowledge, but he was lusty like anything. So this is his great disqualification, was that he thought, although he was so qualified in so many ways, he thought that he was the supreme enjoyer. And therefore, I think as we mentioned yesterday, he gave himself this name, Trilokeshwara, which is actually the name of the Lord. Trilokeshwara means Lord of the Three Worlds. But he considered himself to be the Lord of the Three Worlds. And so, as Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Bhoktaram Jagyatapasam, Sarvaloka Maheshram, he says that one who knows that I, Krishna, am the Lord of all the worlds and am the enjoyer of all sacrifices and am the supreme friend, Gyatva Shantim Charichyati. By this knowledge he attains peace. So this is what was lacking in Ravana. Despite all of his other qualifications, Ravana was actually a Brahmana. Although his mother, you see, his mother was a Rakshashi, but his father was a great sage. So, because of his father, he was also considered a Brahmana. But he had no shanti, he had no sense control. As soon as he saw a beautiful woman, he would become mad. So, therefore, always disturbed, always agitated. He was always creating so much trouble in the universe. This is a demon. Now Ravana, he was called Dasagriva. This is one of his names, that he had 10 necks, 10 heads. And each one of these heads was expert in a different subject matter. So he could, depending on the subject matter, one head would speak so expertly. He was a very persuasive speaker, by the way. By his speaking, he could convince people that day was night. This is why he was such a... Actually, he was a very good leader, very expert leader. All the Rakshashas, the demons, they were so loyal to Ravana because he was so expert in management, so expert in statesmanship. He was so intelligent. So they were fanatical followers of Ravana because they could see he's a demon, but he's so expert. Usually the demons are, you know, they're not so expert like that. He's a demon, he's one of us, but he's so expert. So Because Ravana created so much trouble, he got curses. He got cursed in different ways. Someone cursed him that his city would be burnt down by a monkey. Someone cursed that a monkey would spit in his face, and 10 days after that he would die. So these curses, I mean, they were all to come true. But although Ravana had 10 big brains, 10 heads, he could not understand that these curses would take effect. He was so arrogant, so puffed up, that he didn't consider that these curses were actually the predictions of his demise. Because he thought he was so clever, you see. For instance, he had 10 heads. But these heads, even if they were cut off, they would grow back immediately. You see, this is actually one of the austerities he was performing to become powerful. He was cutting off his own heads and offering them into the fire, but they would immediately grow back. And another point is made here that when, after hearing about Sita Devi, then he was thinking over what he should do. He heard that Sita Devi is so beautiful, and he was immediately attracted. So the idea came into his mind that I should kidnap her. So then he consulted among his 10 heads. And 9 heads were against. 9 different departments. You see, he had 9 heads which were different departments of knowledge. Then he had his own rascal head, which was the final decider of everything. There was one head which decided everything. The other 9 heads were there to give information, so that the one head could decide what to do. So the 9 heads, because they were all endowed with Shastric knowledge, they of course said, it is wrong to kidnap another man's wife. But the one head, the rascal head, the decision-making head, didn't bother about the point of view of the other 9 heads. Then there's this nice story telling how he became cursed, that a monkey would spit in his face. That was a curse by Narada. Once Narada was flying through the sky, and Ravana saw him and ordered him to come down. Come down here before me. So Narada thought, all right. Narada didn't have to do that, but he thought that why should I be the cause of someone's dissatisfaction? He's asked me to come, so I'll come. So then when he stood before Ravana, Ravana demanded, now you teach me the meaning of the syllable Om. And Narada said, I'm sorry. Such knowledge of Brahmagyan is only to be taught to persons who are sense-controlled. You are not sense-controlled. You are very lusty. So you cannot hear this. So Ravana became very angry. And he said, now I'm placing myself before you as your disciple. Now you're my guru. You must instruct me. And Narada said, look, it's still only Treta Yuga. This type of guru-disciple relationship is for Kali Yuga. So your 2 yugas is too early. Don't make demands of me like that. So then Ravana, he took out his sword. He had a sword called Chandrahasa. And this sword was like a guided missile. He didn't have to wield the sword. He would just tell the sword, kill that person. And wherever that person would go, the sword would follow. The person could hide behind stone or iron, the sword would cut through it. The person could make a big magic. If he had mystical powers, the sword would cut through that. The sword was unfailing. It would pursue the target anywhere through the universe and kill him. And return like a boomerang to Ravana's hand. So Ravana pulled out his sword, Chandrahasa, and said, Narada, you see the sword? This is my famous Chandrahasa sword. You teach me Om or I'm going to use it on you. And Narada said, look, whatever you want to do, I'm not going to teach you Om. You're not qualified. And Ravana said, Narada, get ready. Narada said, I'm always ready. So he sent his sword, and the sword went slicing through Narada. But at the end, Narada was just standing there smiling. Nothing happened. And Chandrahasa sword came very sheepishly, very meekly back into Ravana's hand. I did my best. I don't know what happened. Narada is still standing there, completely whole. So then Ravana sent all kinds of other astras, all the astras he had under his command. He had acquired so many astras from his austerities. So he sent them all, and they all attacked Narada and went right through him without affecting him in any way, and then came back. So finally, Ravana, after using up all his astras, he became very humble. And he bowed low before Narada Muni and said, "Narada, please tell me one thing. How is it possible? I've sent these astras that I've sent, they're feared by the demigods. But they haven't harmed you in the least. They just pass right through your body without affecting you. How is that possible?" And Narada Muni replied, "Because I have a spiritual body. My body is not material. It's neither gross matter nor subtle matter. It is spiritual, Satchit Ananda." And Ravana said, "That's what I want. That's what I wanted to get from Brahma in the first place. But he said he couldn't give me that. So Narada, please, I really surrender to you. I put away all my weapons. I'll be a good boy now. You tell me the secret of how I can have a spiritual body, because that's what I've always wanted. A body that can never be harmed by anything. An eternal body." And Narada said, "Actually, you used to have such a body, but you forgot. You got into trouble." He was referring to his earlier existence as the doorkeeper of Vaikuntha, who was cursed by the four Kumaras. "But yes, you can have this spiritual body back, no problem. You just must do one thing." "What is that one thing?" "You have to surrender to Lord Vishnu, become his devotee." And Ravana became furious. "Never!" And he said, "This is all bogus, Narada. You're just talking nonsense. I don't accept this. So get out of here." So he rejected. He had the opportunity, you see. He had the opportunity. But because of having such a hateful attitude towards Lord Vishnu, he refused. So then Narada said, "All right. If that's the way you want to be, then I will give you a blessing in the form of a curse. That Ravana, you will be spit in the face by a monkey." That's a great insult. If a monkey spits you in the face. "And 10 days after that, you will die. So you remember this. Because when the day comes that a monkey spits you in the face, you know that you have only 10 days more." So the story of that is that Angada, who is the son of Sugriva, when Ram, Lakshman, and Sugriva, Hanuman, and Jambavan, and all the whole army of monkeys, when they landed on the shore of Lanka, having crossed the bridge of stones, then the first thing, just as they were touching the earth of Lanka, then the first thing that Angada did was that he... It was Sugriva. Angada came later. Angada actually acted as the messenger a little bit later. But Sugriva, the first thing is that Sugriva jumped from the shore onto the palace tower. Ravana was in his palace tower at the time. And Ravana was just being decorated, you see. He had, all of his attendants were there, and they were making his hair, making his makeup and everything, making him look very beautiful. He was sitting in front of the mirror, looking at himself, admiring himself. And Sugriva leaped up through the window, and simultaneously Sugriva shrank himself down to a very small form, like the size of an insect, and came right in front of Ravana's face and spit in his face. Ravana was shocked. "What's this?" And then he reached out and he grabbed this little insect. And then he looked and he saw it was a little tiny monkey. He said, "What are you doing?" And Sugriva said, "I'm fulfilling Narada's prediction. I just spat in your face." And then he flew back to Lord Ram. But you see, this this demon, this Ravana, was so puffed up, so arrogant. Despite his 10 heads, he was so foolish that although he'd been cursed and the curse came true, he did not think, he didn't take it seriously, that now I have only 10 days to live. Someone with any sense would think, I've got 10 days to live, now I should perfect myself, should make up for all the sins I've committed, surrender to the Lord, get ready. Hopefully, if I can become a sincere devotee in these 10 days, I'll be able to go back home, back to Godhead. He didn't think like that. This is a demon. So, that was our morning Ramayana class. Any questions on this?
I have one question. About
yes?
This liberation, when a demon is killed, then he is receiving impersonal liberation. But I don't understand completely how that is, because he emerges into the body of the Lord, in the form of the Lord. Or is he emerging into the Brahma Jyoti, or what really happens?
Well, it is said there are two kinds of impersonal liberation. One is called Brahma Sayujya, to merge into the effulgence of the Lord, and the other is called Ishvara Sayujya, to actually merge into the body of the Lord. But both are impersonal. Merging into the body of the Lord, we all do. All conditioned souls do it. Even at night, when we sleep, this period known as deep sleep, it is known also to Western psychologists or people who study the sleeping state, whoever they are, whatever they're called, psychologists or sleepologists, I don't know. But they know that for some period of time in the night, then all mental functions are suspended. There are no dreams. It is total unconsciousness. So in Vedic language, this state is called susupti. So for some period of time at night, we enter the state, and what is going on is that in the heart, the jiva actually merges into the Paramatma, merges into the body of Paramatma. For that, this is revealed by Baladeva Vidyabhusan in his Govinda Bhasya commentary, Vedanta Sutra. So that is also. That state we attain of total unconsciousness is the same state that is attained by all living entities when the universe is dissolved and merges back into the body of Mahavishnu. Then for a long, 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 long time, they're in this state of Shushupti. It's something like Brahman realization in the mode of ignorance. It's also a merged state, a state of oneness, but it's a oneness with total unconsciousness, whereas Brahma Sayujya is merging into the light of the Lord's effulgence. So of the two, there's a purport by Srila Prabhupada in Chaitanya Charitamrita where he explains these two forms of liberation, and he says the Ishvara Sayujya is worse because it's merging into this unconsciousness. Yes? This why you have to sleep? Yes, actually it's a fact. The conditioned soul, he becomes weary from his fruitive activities. He needs to be refreshed. So this is how he is refreshed. Sleeping at night, he merges into the body of Paramatma. And he's refreshed in that way. Yes?
Maharaj, this present population of southern India, are they descendants of the people that used to stay there? Because the anthropologists, they have their versions of how India became related. They say that these people are the original people of India, and that the ones in the north, like the white people, are.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they say that the Dravidans, the southern Indians, were very dark in skin color. They say they're actually related with the Aborigines of Australia, the same race. And these people are very old, and they were the original inhabitants of India, and their culture, they think, was rather primitive, or at least it was peaceful, agrarian. They were simple people. And then the Aryans, whom they claim came from somewhere in central Russia originally, the Aryans came down and they conquered the Dravidians, and thus the two races mixed. And that's why you see today the northern Indians are lighter in skin tone and the southern Indians are darker. So this is their theory, and it is based on absolutely no evidence at all. There is neither scriptural evidence, there's nothing in the Vedas which indicate that this happened. Neither is there archaeological evidence. Just the real reason for it is ethnocentricity. This word means that the someone belonging to a particular ethnic group, out of bodily attachment, he tries to make his ethnic group always superior to the others. So the Europeans have respect for Vedic civilization. They cannot hide that Vedic civilization was extremely advanced. The Vedic scriptures speak for themselves. The Sanskrit language speaks for itself. So the Europeans devised, European scholars, this started in the last century, about the middle of the last century, middle towards the end of the last century, these type of speculations, that actually the glories of Indian civilization can be, the root of it can be traced to Europe. The Aryans really came from Europe. Initially, when the Europeans came to India and began to investigate the Vedic scriptures, their initial response was that European civilization has its roots in India. There was a famous, well-known early German Indologist, Sanskritologist named von Schlegel. Around the beginning of the 19th century, 1800, like that. So that was his conclusion. That was the first, and you can understand, first and most obvious conclusion. That he could see that the Vedic scriptures are very ancient, and the knowledge contained within the Vedic scriptures is very vast, highly developed, and he could see how Greek and Latin, these languages which form the basis of European culture, they are derivations, they're coming out of Sanskrit. And he could see how the knowledge, you know, of the, say, the ancient Greek philosophers, it seems to be like an imperfect or partial duplication of Vedic knowledge. So now, he was the first to uncover these things, and that was his conclusion, a very simple, straightforward conclusion. Now, when his book was published in the West, then it was accepted at first, but then other scholars started to think that, wait a minute, now what this means is that our culture, European culture, is inferior to those Indians. Now, how can that be? Because now India's come under the control of the British, who are Europeans. So, you know, and the British especially became worried that such kinds of ideas, this will undermine our whole standing in India. So then other scholars gradually started to come up, as scholars do, you know, there's one theory comes out, and then other scholars come 20 years later with some other theory to counteract that. So gradually the theories evolved to this point, that the Aryans came out of central Russia somewhere. In the last century, the 19th century, that's the current theory, that Aryans came out of central Russia. But different scholars in the last century, they're from different countries, like some scholars from Germany were saying they came from Germany, some scholars from France were saying the Aryans came from France. But then they found they couldn't get away with that, so they moved it over to the Caucasian mountains. That's also, you know, this word Caucasian is also used for white-skinned people. So this is where this idea comes from. It's just European ethnocentrism. There's no other, there's no proof for this at all. It's just a complete fantasy. It's based on a very, of course, they will say, well, you know, they will cite something from Vedic scriptures and old Vedic scriptures and from the scriptures of Iran, the Zendavesta, which is in a language similar to Sanskrit. But this is also very, very poor interpretation of the scriptures. This has been shown by scholars, how this interpretation of the scriptures is very, very forced, very artificial, not at all scholarly. But somehow or other, this idea, although there's no scholarly basis for it anymore, it is stuck. Of course, now Indian scholars, they refute this. That's an interesting debate, if one is into these things. How the Indian scholars, they give evidence to refute this Western theory. Yes?
You said in a lecture, Maharaj, that one of the demons was performing austerities in an astral body. Is that same as the subtle body?
Yes, I think I said subtle body.
No, you said astral body.
Okay.
And the second question is, Lord Paramatma, it is Lord Vishnu in the heart. But we know that Lord Vishnu is always in the company with Lakshmi Devi. Where is Lakshmi Devi?
Well, Lord Vishnu expands, you see. Mahavishnu expands as Garbhodakashaya Vishnu, and Garbhodakashaya Vishnu expands as Chirudakashaya Vishnu. So the Chirudakashaya Vishnu, he dwells in the ocean of milk. He is the same Paramatma in the heart, but he lives in Svetadvip, in the ocean of milk, and there is Lakshmi. But he further expands into the hearts. It's the same Svetadvip Vishnu, but he expands. The example is given of the sun in the sky and sun in pots. So he expands further into the heart of all living entities. So there he's standing on a lotus flower. He's not on Shesh, on Anantashesh. And Lakshmi is not massaging his feet in that form. So that's his expansion. But in his original form as Supersoul, he's on Svetadvip, the milk ocean. And there is Lakshmi Devi. Yes?
Sorry. Okay. There is this painting by Jadurani of Lord Vishnu standing in the water, tell us where he's
mm-hmm.
Usually he is, I understood that he is lying, but now he's standing in the water.
Mm-hmm.
What is the meaning of the
Not offhand. That is also a form of Vishnu, and there is, but offhand I don't know. I've come across this, but it slips my mind right now. Sorry. A long time ago I found out about this. I have to look it up again. Yes.
Maharaj, I read recently some very beautiful excerpts from Vidyananda Maharaj translation of Mahabharata.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, that will smash all kind of speculations and historical evidences, and so-called evidences. So I read that actually before Lord Krishna appeared in Yadu dynasty, demons, they started with great plan. They started entering wombs of wives of earthly kings just to establish their atheistic kingdom. And they start killing brahmanas and sages and all kinds of things. So how we can relate nowadays? Is that still going on? Or I don't want to speculate. I just want to see that.
Yes, it is stated in Bhagavatam. Rakshashim kalim ashrita. Brahmani jayante yonishu. That in the Kali Yuga, demons take birth within the wombs of Brahmin families. So, and it also says that thieves and rogues will become kings in this Kali Yuga. So yes, there's many, many demons who are constantly taking birth.
I mean, relating to Hitler, some other, really.
why Hitler? It could be anybody. Compared to Hiranyakashipu, they're all little demons. So Hitler is also a little demon. The guy down the street running that slaughterhouse, he's also a little demon. The butcher just a few doors down, another little demon. Demons are everywhere.
So yes? I'm sorry, just to finish my question. So that means that these Maharashis, they simply taking birds into wombs of the mothers, or, you know,
yes,
there are some other reasons for appearance of such a huge number of demons, actually.
Well, it's Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, they have a chance to appear in human society on a very, very broad scale. In previous ages, it was more restricted. Prabhupada gave this formula. He said, previously, in the Satyuga, the demigods and demons, and demigods also includes human beings as a lower form of demigods. They're supposed to be on the side of the demigods to really be considered human beings. So the demigods and demons were separated by different planets, different planetary systems separated them. And then in the Treta Yuga, different continents separated them. For instance, in the Treta Yuga, we were just reading about Lanka. So Lanka was a continent, and all the demons were there. Everywhere else were human beings, but there were the demons. In the Dwarpa Yuga, as we see, you've just mentioned the pastimes of Krishna, they were separated by different countries or different family groups. The Mahabharata war was a war of, on one side, the Kaurava side, there were the impious kings, and on the Pandava side, there were the pious kings. And in the Kali Yuga, everything is so mixed up that you can even have a devotee and a demon in the same body. We're all trying to become devotees, but we have to admit we have our demoniac nature that we struggle with. So it is so mixed up in this age. So practically the demoniac nature is all pervading. So Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, propagating the holy name of the Lord, this purifying sound vibration, effectively counteracts this demoniac mentality. Everyone's a demon in Kali Yuga, practically speaking. Everyone's a demon. But by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, this demoniac mentality is driven out by the purifying vibration of the holy name. So that's the only hope. Shamananda, you had a question?
Yes, my question actually about this, how this is hard actually in Kali Yuga, as I heard before. Mm-hmm. This demoniac nature is not something external, somebody is demon and I'm devotee, I'm 3 months in movement and now divine, and somebody there on the street is pure demon.
Well, the demons are also out there, no doubt, but we have enough trouble with our own material conditioning, demoniac conditioning. You had another question? Gurupad? No? Okay.
What's then the reason of these two, the Dravidians in South India and North India? Two different races?
Well, that's explained by Srila Prabhupada in the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita, that India is divided, North India is divided into 5 regions, Pancha Gaura Desh, and South India is divided into 5 regions, the Pancha Dravida Desh. So these are just different countries. But the culture of India is the same. It's Vedic culture. Like the Westerners, they argue that the Dravidian languages, or the South Indian languages, they come from a different source. But it's not a fact. I mean, that may be a Western imposition, but the Dravidians themselves, scholars, they have the books of the history of their language. It also comes from Sanskrit.
Including this Tamil language?
Yeah, Tamil language has Sanskrit roots. Of course, it is said that one sage, I think it was Agastya, there's a story that the Tamil language was given by a sage. It's a particular, you know, form of language which was given by one sage. But one who knows the origins, Admatattva Prabhu was telling me there's books of the history of the Tamil language, and as one goes back, one finds it becomes more and more like Sanskrit. The thing is that you see the Brahmins, there are Brahmins in North India, Brahmins in South India. The Brahmins are one race. They're not different races of Brahmins. The Brahmin Gotras, they all have one common source. Ultimately, they come from Brahma. By different lines, Brahma's sons, they come down different lines. And the Kshatriyas also. So when you talk about these different races in India now, you're talking about lower classes, lower class people. The Brahmanas, the Kshatriyas, the higher classes, actually descending from the demigods, descending from Manu. And so they're in north, they're in south. Local people, low-class people, that's another thing. But low-class people are everywhere. What's the reason? Well, according to the Vedas, Shukla, the lighter skin, means they're more pious. Darker skin means more impious. Yes?
Is there a particular reason why the language all over the world, Sanskrit, was changed into other languages and why it was also performed by sages?
Well, Sanskrit is the language of the demigods and the language of the Vedic sages. It's not that everybody in the whole world was speaking Sanskrit. Yes, there is what is called Apabhramsa. There is Apabhramsa. There are Prakrit dialects of Sanskrit. It's like all the languages of India, practically speaking, are deviations. It's like the educated people, they spoke Sanskrit, and then lower class people, they spoke a kind of dialect of that. But there are some languages in this world which seem to have no connection to Sanskrit, like Chinese. It comes from another region. Sanskrit comes from the demigods. The demons also have their culture. And earth is in between. So earth gets influenced by demigods and by demons. Yeah, but the demons desire to be different. Yeah, so they get their facility from the Lord to be different. They want to live, they live in a place under the earth human beings, demigods live in the light of the sun. Demons don't want that. They want to live in darkness. So their culture is very, very much different. That's also supplied by the Lord. They simply want to be different. They want to have a different everything. So they get it. Also different language.
When Krishna was in Vrindavan, was he speaking Brijbasi, Hindi?
It says he was speaking all languages.
Everything, right.
Speaking the language of the animals and the birds.
Right.
The demigods would come and see him, so he would speak to them in their language. But he would the Brijbasis, they have their own language.
Yeah.
Brajabasa. It's their own language. Yes?
It is described, I think, in Mahabharata. In the previous ages, all kinds of different creatures from other ages were coming to the earth. For example, Rakshasas. Is it going on now? Is there some example for that?
Rakshasas coming to the earth?
For example.
Well, as I said, Rakshasas are taking birth on the earth in the form of Brahmins or everywhere. Generally, it is said that demigods don't come here. They used to, but they don't anymore because the earth has become so degraded. Rakshasas may come. I'm not going to talk about it because they may come. Usually these entities, you know, when you talk about them, they appear. Yes?
This 10,000 years, this is attractive for the demigods to come down to the earth and to free themselves to go back to the...
Yes, because of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. They were already coming down 500 years ago to participate in the Sankirtan movement.
This 10,000 years, it's possible that demigods may...
Why not? All right. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.